Welcome back, everybody, to our in-depth coverage of the Gaza ceasefire. The Hamas resistance movement has hailed the Gaza ceasefire agreement, which was achieved following intense negotiations by mediators. We've been talking to various guests and analysts to get more insight on the implementations of this ceasefire. Now joining us is our very own Maryam Ozacher, who's with us in the studio here in Tehran to give us some more insight on what we're looking at right now. Maryam, it's great to have you with us. Let's jump right in and talk to us about the implications of the ceasefire and what it means for the resilience and the resistance of the Palestinians in Gaza, most notably the resistance fighters there.
Well, thank you, Bardia. Now, what today is, I mean, what the ceasefire deal, it was the biggest defeat the Israeli regime has ever suffered since its very illegitimate inception, basically. So, I mean, and I honestly, it's probably going to be the beginning of the end of the Zionist regime. And what this defeat means, I mean, think about it. Netanyahu talked about, oh, we're going to go into Gaza, we're going to destroy Hamas, there will no longer be Hamas in Gaza. And in some ways, he was correct. I mean, Hamas is no longer only in Gaza, it's in West Bank. It's all over the world. There are so many people who had no idea what Palestine is, who had only heard about the Israeli regime as, you know, the only democracy in what they call the Middle East and what we call the West Asia. So this is what the minds of millions of people across the world was completely foreign, and not only just foreign, but also a lot of Zionist propaganda over the years. We had seen how they used the basically Holocaust as an excuse, how they have constantly talked about, oh, you know, we had, you know, the highest numbers that, of course, you know, are all up for debate, of course, that, oh, so, you know, this happened to the Jews, therefore they have the right to occupy somebody else's land as their homeland. And I mean, even with the occupations being illegal under international rights, the occupation constantly happened and constantly expanded, and people in the world didn't know about it. But now, I mean, think about Hamas is no longer in Gaza. It's everywhere. Hamas sympathizers are everywhere across the world. A lot of European countries that, I mean, with all the billions of dollars, I mean, imagine it's been over seven decades of illegal occupation of Palestine, and all of the Western media, all of the Western hegemonic front, all of the legal systems, all of the international systems, they were all built around giving this image, giving this victim card to the Zionists, who are actually very anti-Semitic in many ways, to basically occupy land and murder people. But what the Zionist regime did with is, you know, the latest round of genocide in Gaza, what they did was they made sure everybody in the world now knows what Palestine is, everybody in the world now knows what resistance is. And most dangerous of all to the Western hegemonic front, I mean, in the past, people had these fairy tale ideas of how the world works. So, you know, they would believe, oh, there are these, you know, a lot of people in the world, because, you know, of course, the media doesn't, mainstream media doesn't allow for people to be educated for the most part. And a lot of people believe that, oh, you know, there's these so-called, you know, the savior countries. There's the U.S., there's the country of Batman and Superman, and, you know, they always save the day, they always save the world. And they're always pushing for democracy in the world, they're always pushing for human rights in the world. So one, they thought of these powers as, you know, basically the flag bearers of security and democracy and human rights. And then they also believed in the power of international organizations to do something, and I mean, for one, in their willingness, which was really, I mean, it's preposterous, because you cannot have a legal system where only five entities have the veto right. And we saw how many times the U.S. has used its veto right to protect the Zionist regime. So this is the whole perception of people across the world about the Western hegemonic front, about international organizations, and about how you can defend your rights in this world. Everything has changed. Everything has broken down. Like, now you're realizing that actually the path to freedom is resistance. The path to end occupation is resistance. And we saw how many times, you know, a ceasefire was proposed by, you know, especially as it gained momentum, as more and more people learned about this and they pushed their governments and basically even more representatives in the United Nations, they pushed for the ceasefire, but the U.S. never allowed for it until they realized they can't do anything about it. And I mean, Blinken said, I mean, of course, Blinken has done a whole 180 from the time from his last, you know, a point of talking about, you know, Hamas must be eradicated, to, well, look at what the Israeli regime has done is that basically Hamas forces, more people have joined Hamas now, potentially, as there were to begin with. And that's only the official forces, not talking about everybody who's pro-resistance across the world. So I would say it's definitely the biggest defeat for the Zionist regime, but not only that, a major defeat for the entire Western Hegemonic Front, a major defeat for international organizations. And because people are realizing how the world actually works, and that doesn't look too good for major powers.
Right, and just focusing on that point, Mariam, the global awakening to this, because it was a global awakening before this genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. We didn't see this level of awareness with regards to the Palestinian cause, with regards to the suffering of Gazans. So that global awakening to the suffering of the Palestinian people and the aggressive nature of the occupying regime, that resulted in an unprecedented place of isolation for Israel. How has this global awakening to the Israeli crimes against Palestinians basically changed the narrative to this occupation?
I mean, it's very interesting. Now, look at a lot of people in the world where, you know, the way they talked about what terrorism is and what it actually looks like. It looks like some bearded guy with some elementary weapon in West Asia, right? This is what it looked like to a lot of people. Now, if you ask a lot of people who are your heroes in this whole, you know, with everything that happens, they say Yemenis, right? A lot of people are looking at these fighters that they were willing to be bombed, but to stop the ships that were facilitating genocide. They were willing to be bombed, they were willing to be killed, but protect Palestinians. I mean, and then we had all of these people. So really, people's perception of what a morality was, people's perception of basically who is actually on the side of morality and what is a regime and what is with everything. I mean, like, they looked at these, you know, the U.S. had this axis of evil countries, or, you know, like, you know, they always talked about Iran, for instance, you know, this oppressive regime, that they kept predicting that, oh, it's going to fall, because, I mean, they were announcing their own plans to bring about what they call regime change, right? So now they see that this Iran was the country that facilitated resistance, and it actually didn't. I mean, unlike what the U.S. does to its allies, it forces, you know, basically submission. We saw what happened when Germany wanted to continue buying oil from Russia, for instance, right? They bombed the pipelines. So, but what happens with Iran is it has empowered resistance across the world, and it sat back. It's like, you can defend your own country. You have the knowledge, you have learned how to make your own weapons, you have the right ideology. And again, I mean, this whole ideological battle and this whole entire thing, we talked about, you know, the Israeli captives that were released. I mean, that in itself was a major story. So every time Israeli captives were released, the Zionist regime was actually more nervous. I'm sure they were very much hoping that they would be killed, you know, because, I mean, and actually a lot of these captives were killed by the bombings of the Israeli regime, because they would come out of the basically being held captive by Hamas, completely adoring Hamas, you know, being like, you know, the way they treated us, the way they treated children, the way, I mean, they saw this whole, you know, idea of, oh, morality in play is when you have captives, you actually have power over them. You can do whatever you want, and nobody can stop you. And look at how they treat us. Look at how they treat us who have been stealing their homes, occupying their homes, because, you know, they're no Israeli civilians, right? Because it's a mandatory military service for everyone. So, you know, the whole concept of morality, who are the moral countries? who are the moral forces? And I mean, when talking about morality, because a lot of, for a long time in the West, they have tried to basically remove concepts of morality and talk about freedoms. Talk about, for instance, instead of having religious values, oh, we value freedom of speech. And of course, you know, depending on what country, you know, freedom of speech can go very extreme and it can hurt a lot of lives. And they used to say that it didn't matter. But look at what happened when people rose up in defense of Palestinians, when they started wearing the Palestinian scarf, the kafia, when they started wearing the Palestinian flag, when the people were getting arrested for wearing pins on their clothes in countries that have been the you know, flag bearers of freedom of speech. I mean, the most brutal crackdowns, some of the most brutal crackdowns on protesters happened in Germany. So people are like, okay, so you have talked about, you have basically dismissed religion in politics, and you have put up, you have instead hailed these what you call values of, you know, this extreme freedom of speech, extreme freedom of expression. And now people saw that that freedom is actually not complete freedom. And in fact, it's a freedom that you cannot use when you most need it. It's a freedom you cannot use when children were being blown to bits. You cannot use that freedom there. You cannot even use the freedom, not only, I mean, forget about saying something, but to even walk out in the street with a kafia around your neck. I mean, they were running the if there's footage of police running after little kids with the Palestinian flag. And I mean, this is just, you know, so much has been dismantled throughout this latest round of genocide in Palestine. So much has been dismantled. And I mean, partially thanks to the heinous crimes of the Israeli regime, and they had no problem with showing it in front of the camera, bragging about it, you know, bombing people's homes, and as though they're playing a video game with everything they did to children. They were going, you know, breaking into people's homes. They killed children, they killed people with mental disabilities, they destroyed hospitals. I mean, in northern Gaza, there are no more functioning hospitals, right? And of course, there's always an excuse, right? So imagine if the value, if the morality is, if the law is that you cannot bomb a hospital, but when a genocidal regime that's famous for lying, I mean, nobody has in throughout history has made as many false accusations and lies as the Israeli regime. So all they have to do to break the law of you cannot bomb hospitals is to say, oh, well, Hamas is, we know, we have reason to think Hamas is underneath the hospital. Oh, well, you know, I guess that's enough reason to basically flatten all kinds of construction. So people saw, people actually got to see, people actually got to witness what international rights is in practice, what Western morality is in practice. And a lot of people are basically going back in their thinking, they're starting, a lot of people are actually starting to read the Quran because they see, okay, so there's something that all of this resistance has in common. They're all Muslim, right? And of course, they're the Muslims that are actually not American allies. So this is interesting because, I mean, we know that, you know, like the US itself, over the years, hasn't really had a problem with any country just because they call themselves Muslim, right? So we had, for instance, Saudi Arabia, very good relationship with the US, right? They executed 81 people in one day. Who cares? You know, they're US allies. You know, it basically anything can be overlooked for US allies. And some okay. of the most extreme, and I mean, what helps on top of everything else is when people witness what happened in Syria, because the same Western hegemonic front that always said, oh, you know, a religion should not be in politics, that always said, oh, you know, there are these extremists, we have to destroy the extremists, we have to bring in the moderate, you know, representatives of people who are actually, you know, the ones not with the crazy beards and with the ties and the ones who don't enforce religion. And people see that this same Western hegemonic front has put in power a former Daesh, aka ISIS leader. This is what people see. So they're like, okay, wait a minute. So these people don't actually have any concept of morality. These Western Hegemonic Front actually doesn't have any concept of morality. That when they say they have a problem with extremism also, it's only when it doesn't serve their rights. That they have a problem with actually moderation, because moderation will stand in the face of occupation. Moderate people will not allow their country being taken, will not be allow their children to be put in prisons, just like over 10,000 Palestinians are in Israeli prisons without any rights, without any, you know, and all taken mostly for, you know, basically arbitrary reasons. Like, for a child could be thrown for as little as throwing a stone at a tank. I mean, and we have footage of course, sniping Israeli sniping children for doing that much. Because why? Because their home was stolen away from them, because their land was taken away from them. So people are seeing how everything is in play right now. Morality, religion, extremism, a lot of these concepts have changed forever. So the Western Hegemonic Front, and it's different, basically, it's different branches, and it's different arms, basically. They all have to go over a complete modification in order to just survive. This is what's happened. And I mean, this is what's the greatest victory, not just for the Palestinian people, but for the entire resistance front.
Maryam, we mentioned the role of regional support in this genocidal war, but also we have to reflect on that in the long run in support of the Palestinian struggle. Now, head of Hamas in Gaza, Khalil al-Hayya, he expressed gratitude to Iran and the resistance front for their unwavering support for Gaza during Israel's genocidal war. How has support from countries like Lebanon, like Yemen, and Iraq as well, how have they strengthened the Palestinian cause? And also, what kind of a role did these nations play in assisting Palestinians to endure the fight against the occupation?
Well, as you know, it all started in Iran, right, with the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran following the People's Revolution. The first leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, said was, if you do not stop the Israeli regime, it will not suffice to Palestine. It will go further and further. It will take Syria. It will take other countries. And look what's happened. Look what they're talking about. Now they're talking about Lebanon being part of their land. Now they're talking about the map of the greater Israel. There's Jordan, there's Lebanon, there's Saudi Arabia, there's all these countries that are like, well, actually they're ours, and now they have occupied Syria. So, I mean, you know, we talk about all this. So it all started with that first ideology that Imam Khomeini talked about. He basically said, if you don't stop an imperialist, and we know the Zionist regime is basically the bastard child of Western colonialism. That's what it is. And Imam Khomeini saw this over four decades ago. And he said, if you don't stop the Zionist regime, if Muslim nations, I mean, he could already see that there would be a day that, you know, certain regimes that are ruling over Muslims across the world are gonna try and normalize with the Zionist regime. And he said that if Muslims don't rise up, the Zionist regime will get to you too. It will not stop in Palestine. So Iran had Quds Day before anybody was even talking about, you know, basically that kind of solidarity. That every year, the last Friday of every Ramadan, every holy month of Ramadan, Iranians, millions and millions of Iranians, took to the streets, chanted slogans against Israeli occupation, chanted slogans for the support of Palestinians. And so, in one way, I mean, some of the people who feel the most victorious are actually the Iranian people, because this has been their struggle as well. Because when you understand, you know, when you do not stop an aggressor at your neighbor's house, it will come to your house. There's no way. There's no way that you allow this kind of basically imperial entity to take over all the neighboring countries and you'd be safe in the middle. That's not going to happen. And actually, Iran has suffered as a result of Israeli regime's sabotage operations, the assassination of Iranian scientists. So Iran started with that basically call of all Muslim nations to come together and support the Palestinian people and not allow for the expansion of the occupation of the Israeli regime. Of course, a lot of these Arab nations, I mean, what they did finally, you know, they ended up normalizing with the Zionist regime, despite the protests of their people, despite the protests of the majority of the people who had no power in the governance of their country. So, and what
Very
Iran
well.
Also did, yes.
All right, hold that thought. Mariam, we're going to bring in international lawyer Barry Grossman joining us from Bali, Indonesia. Mr. Grossman, welcome to the program. I want to get your perspective on the ceasefire agreement, its implementation, as well. And we were talking about the resilience and the resistance of victory that this has brought about due to the resistance of the Palestinian fighters. What lessons do you think the resistance success will hold for the future struggle against the Israeli occupation?
I think the main takeaway is that now, as long as Palestinians and the resistance more generally hold to their aims, there's nobody that can beat them. Now, victory may come, as it has in this instance, at an extremely high cost. But at the end of the day, if we look at this horrible incident over the last 15 or 16 months, Israel has not really achieved any of the aims that it set for itself. We've all said that those aims were unachievable all along, and in fact, the reports that I'm seeing are suggesting that far more new recruits to Hamas have been obtained as this has played out, that have been lost to the war. So with the regime, with an occupation like that perpetrated by the Zionists, there's really nobody who can beat the Palestinian resistance, because the Palestinian resistance ultimately is not prepared to give up or fly the white flag, whatever price has to be paid. And sometimes the price is, of course, tragically high. But at the end of the day, the resistance will be successful in achieving what it has set out to achieve for the last eight decades.
And Mr. Grossman, until the final day of the Israeli-American genocide against Gaza, until this ceasefire is implemented, the occupying forces, they continue to suffer losses with their soldiers falling at the hands of the resistance fighters. What does this say about the effectiveness of the Palestinian fighters, given how imbalanced and asymmetrical I wouldn't even call it a war, this genocidal battle was?
Well, imagine if Palestinians hadn't been subjected to an embargo all of these years, and had even the most rudimentary armaments that are needed to fight the kind of military force, the military might that's been thrown at them by the Israelis at a cost to American citizens of many tens of billions of dollars. Things would have never got anywhere near as far as they have. The fact that Palestinians have managed to keep fighting largely with homemade weapons, hand-to-hand combat, the odd bit of homemade artillery speaks very loud to the commitment of the resistance and the utter failings of modern technological warfare when you're dealing with, on the one hand, a cause which is reprehensible and totally illegitimate, and on the other hand, a cause which is about as pure as it comes, that is, the right for an occupied people to exercise both their God-given and their the right as recognized in natural and international law to engage in armed resistance. And it's very revealing, of course, that when people in Europe did it during World War II, the resistance cause fought by some people in France and Greece and Holland and other places was seen as a heroic cause. But the moment, and in fact, it went on for many decades afterwards in the form of clandestine black ops in Europe conducted by the security apparatus in conjunction with the United States. They set up stay-behind resistance forces, which ultimately engaged in terrorism. But when Palestinians exercise that lawful right, they're dismissed as terrorists and they're murdered in their tens, if not hundreds of thousands.
And back to you, Mariam. A lot of issues, you know, come to mind when we're talking about the resilience of the Palestinians, not just the Palestinian resistance groups, but also Gazans as well, as we've seen them maintaining their steadfastness amid this gut-wrenching massacre, the day-to-day gut-wrenching massacres and destruction that we're seeing on our phones, basically live in real time, as to you mentioned earlier, as to how unapologetically the Israelis were carrying out these crimes. In your opinion, what drives the Palestinians to resist despite this overwhelming adversity that we've been seeing?
I mean, a big part of it is having been at the front for decades, right? Because what they have seen, what the stories they have heard, basically, of their grandparents, a lot of these Palestinians in Gaza have been displaced from all across Palestine, right? So these are the people who have experienced firsthand the occupation. These are the people who have seen the murder of their loved ones. I mean, there are interviews from years ago, from decades ago, Palestinian children talking about their parents being shot in front of them, right, by the Israeli regime. So everybody who is raised in Palestine, there are a few different things. One is on a daily basis, they see the injustice, they see the occupation. There are checkpoints that they cannot move freely in their own country, in their own city. For any arbitrary reason, they may not be allowed to go from one side to another side of their own city. They can be taken to prison for no reason. They can be, so they have experienced this firsthand for decades now. So this is not, I mean, with people across the world, because they were more removed from the situation, mainstream media could fool them into thinking that, oh, actually, you know, it's this land that it was actually to begin with, it was for the Zionist regime, and they're like the only democracy in West Asia, that they're, you know, nice and everything, right? Palestinians won't buy those lies because they see the truth on a daily basis, right? So this is one, they're front and center at the resistance, but also, I mean, I actually had I talked to one of the guests, one of the Gazan guests we had, and I mean, I talked to him about like, what makes your people so strong, because they're very resilient. And he says, look, every house has a martyr. So children grow up knowing that at some point in their life, they will give their life to protect their loved ones, because there doesn't seem to be any other choice, and because to do so is an honor, that when the enemy has invaded your home, when they have taken away your loved ones, to fight for them is an honor. And he said that especially in Gaza, there are so many even children who have memorized the entire Quran. He said at every alley, at every street, you see Quran classes. That is very much a strong ideology. And what is the ideology? The ideology is death with dignity is better than a life of oppression, a life of occupation, a life of being destroyed and having to watch your women raped and having to watch all kinds of atrocities. That they are raised in that, they're raised with that ideology. And really, I mean, they grow resilient. You have seen when they take these children to the hospitals, they have lost an arm, they have lost a leg, sometimes they have lost their entire family. And the way the nurses treat them, like, you're strong, get up, you can do it. You know, this is very much a culture. And they have been raised with this. They have seen this front, they have been front and center in this battle. So this is what makes it even less possible, I mean, more impossible, when they talk about the destruction of Hamas. Hamas is Palestinians. Palestinians are Hamas. There is no division. And this is, I mean, this is what what the fact of the matter is. I mean, when a ceasefire was announced, people were chanting in the streets, "Mohammed Daif, we're your soldiers." You know, they were saying, you know, and Hamas was, you know, the soldiers were celebrating with the people. They're saying, "We're not going anywhere," because people showed that they are willing to defend with their tears and with their blood. They're willing to defend and hold on to their resistance and hold on because they see this is the only way they can have. Basically, they can get rid of this occupation. This is the only way they'll ever have a home. This is the only way they'll ever enjoy half the human rights the West talks about, right? So they support the resistance, and their children grow up to become resistance. You know, of course, we have to be very careful in talking about these things, because what the U.S. tries to show is that, oh, well, you know, people become, of course, what they call terrorists and what we call freedom fighters, is that when they have nothing to lose. No, this is not a suicide mission. These Palestinians are not going out, you know, to be like, I'm trying to become martyred, I'm trying to become killed to, you know, attain this honor. They are trying to defend their country as it's instructed by their ideology, as it's instructed, frankly, by common sense, by any stand of morality. Protecting the weak in your country is an honor, right? So the West tries to show, I mean, even those who try to give a more humane face to the Palestinians who have been, you know, portrayed horribly in Western media for decades. Well, they say, expect? You killed their parents, they have nothing to lose. But really, they have everything to gain from protecting their land, for protecting their people, and the ideology only makes them stronger.
Back to Greg Rossman in Indonesia. Let's talk about the issue of accountability and justice. Many believe that international legal efforts must be activated to prosecute the Israeli war criminals for the crimes that they've committed, the crimes of extermination, crimes of genocide. What steps, in your opinion, must be taken to prosecute the Israeli war criminals in international courts, given how ineffective these international institutions have shown to be, most notably the likes of the United Nations, which is at the mercy, the United Nations Security Council, rather, which is at the mercy of the veto-wielding members there who, like the United States, France, and Britain, always give their support to the Israeli regime.
Well, I mean, obviously the mechanisms are in play, as we say. There are cases running both at the ICC and the ICJ. Unfortunately, the process takes many, many years, and there'll be many changes of personnel and character as the case rolls on. And of course, that's what both the Americans and the Israelis specialize in, dragging things out when they need to drag things out so they can wait until people who are less favorable to them are replaced by people who are. But at the end of the day, you know, the process, even though the law is quite clear, is an inherently political process. And I can't really think of many instances in which anybody or any nation has been held to account for war crimes, let alone genocide, without having the bulk of the Atlantic world powers on board. And of course, that's the great obstacle here. The bulk of the Atlantic world powers, whether it be by hook or crook or blackmail or just being willing, have always favored supporting the Israelis and the occupation, notwithstanding what they do in the region, over allowing justice to be done. But at the end of the day, it's really up to the people who support Palestine to keep the issues hot, to keep protesting, keep writing to and lobbying their representatives in legislative bodies, and ultimately for the General Assembly at the United Nations to continue passing resolutions calling the Security Council into account. It's certainly high time for there to be a reckoning about the way the Security Council operates. It's quite clear that the veto power, which is routinely used by countries like America, which itself, like Israel, has opted out of almost all international treaties that go to humanitarian law and the rules of warfare, that, you know, they're pursuing it for their own bent political and ideological purposes rather than using their veto to make sure that justice be done. There are mechanisms contemplated by the UN charter that would allow the General Assembly to step in and seize itself of the matter. Otherwise, there clearly has to be some kind of an amendment that sees countries like the U.S. held to account for the way they wield this veto, which in effect is to, for purposes of the exact opposite of what they're supposed to be doing, that is ensuring respect for human rights and ensuring regional security.
Let's go back to Mariam Prestes. Mariam Ozarcher was with us in our studio here in Tehran. Mariam, we had some breaking news a little earlier. A reaction from an Israeli far-right minister regarding the ceasefire. That minister, I guess we can probably assume who it was, but the minister said that this ceasefire is a danger to Israel's security. Let's break that down, if you may. And also, we can't ignore all the internal divisions in Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu's role in the continued suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza. Many believe that this ceasefire right now in this phase could have effectively mean the end of the ultra-right-wing government in Israel.
Well, I mean, this latest round of genocide was effectively a beginning of the beginning of the end to the Israeli regime, because what happened was the whole world saw actually what the Israeli regime was doing. That before that, you know, there were not so many. I mean, all the posts that were constantly being filtered by mainstream media, by social media, all the everything that was being basically hidden, it was revealed. But also, I mean, occupation is a danger to the Israeli regime, right? Because if you don't want to be in danger, you don't go steal someone's home. They might come back and take it away from you. They might come back and do something to you. That's very common sense, right? So really, you cannot be safe in another one's land. The only thing to do is to get out of somebody else's land, to allow, you know, what Iran has called, what the Iranian leader has called, Iran's leader of the revolution, Imam Khamenei, has called to begin with for a referendum, that it will not be ruled, that the Palestinian land will not be ruled by the Israeli regime, but by the vote of the Palestinians themselves, Palestinians who are Jewish, who are Christian, who are Muslim, who are from all of these different, backgrounds and thoughts. And yes, there's a lot of division in the Zionist regime itself that will only make matters even harder for the Israeli regime. Of course, there is a problem, because the kind of mentality that the Zionists are brought up with, the kind of mentality that is taught in their school, is that this racist ideology of superiority, this ideology that they have the right to do whatever they want, you know, and nobody has the right to stop them, and they can just play the victim card. A lot of them opposed the genocide, but the reason they opposed this genocide was that they had their children taken captive by Hamas. This was the reason they were saying free the captives. This is why they were mad at their regime, not because, you know, a lot of them were very concerned about the well-being of Palestinians. Of course, you know, in every country there are those who can escape the highest extent of brainwashing and still remain human. But we have to say that even with their division. The division is not on whether or not Palestinians have the right to their own land, to their own resources, to basically food and water. The division is based on what keeps the Zionist regime stronger. The division is based on, you know, they're saying, oh, you had to continue the battle because we want to take up more land, or you have to stop the battle because, you know, our people are captives. Of course, not minding the thousands upon thousands of Palestinians effectively being held hostage in Israeli prisons. So yes, the division will definitely basically facilitate the fall of the Zionist regime over time, of course. But it's not a division over, you know, whether or not we should not commit genocides, whether or not we should not kill children, whether or not we should not bomb hospitals. The division is mostly basically all about how can we maintain the Israeli regime that basically that we can continue to survive. And it's a very much existential battle for the Zionist regime, because it was, I mean, it, you know, the regime officials, they knew that what they were doing, basically the world has turned against them. People across the world have wakened up, but they were very much trying to avoid having to do ceasefire, having to accept to get out of Gaza. Of course, we know the Israeli regime, I mean, they never abide by anything. Hours after the announcement of the ceasefire, again, they killed at least 32 Palestinians. I mean, the number might have increased by now, but I mean, of course, we know that they don't, you know, abide by any of their promises. But the fact that they have had to agree to a ceasefire is it is also in part, as you said, due to a divide within the Israeli regime, that in order to occupy, you have to have people willing to stay there and occupy, and the people who have been shipped to the Palestinian land from Poland and elsewhere, you know, a lot of them have another country to go to when they don't feel safe in the occupation. So, I mean, of course, that has basically contributed to the ceasefire.
Barry Grossman, looking at the next steps following this ceasefire, that would be rebuilding Gaza and the long-term support for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Now, leading during this genocidal massacre, there was a lot of criticism directed towards Arab countries, certain Arab regimes that were in fact U.S. allies in the region, and also a lot of criticism towards Arab institutions for not putting enough pressure on the Israelis to stop this genocidal massacre. So now that the ceasefire is going to be implemented, hopefully, and the Israelis hold up their end of the bargain, what role should Arab and Islamic nations play basically in rebuilding Gaza and supporting the Palestinians in Gaza in the long run?
Well, before I embrace that, let me just point out that the next step actually is to negotiate a ceasefire. You know, it's very typical of the occupation to say that a ceasefire has been agreed when it's really just a short-term ceasefire that calls for further negotiations to agree to a permanent ceasefire. So
sure,
the next step in this equation is to negotiate terms on which the ceasefire becomes permanent and the occupiers leave the Gaza Strip in its entirety. And needless to say, there's going to be a lot of points of contention taken by the occupiers, and of course no nation is more predictable in when it comes to violating its agreements and its commitments than Israel is, with the possible exception maybe of the United States. So there's still a long way to go before we can safely say that this is over. In fact, it's a bit like, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu is a bit like a game show. Maybe he thinks he's Monty Hall, because he's now called the Hamas leadership up to the stage to go through another round of let's make a deal. And of course, if you pick the wrong curtain in let's make a deal, you go home with nothing. So we'll have to see where this all leads to and how it unfolds. It's It's rather tragic, though, that the same proposal, which Biden put forward many, many months ago, and which Hamas in principle agreed to, was pushed aside by the occupation, requiring many months more of war and tens of thousands of additional Palestinian lives. If we get past that, we'll get to the question of rebuilding. And of course, the Arab countries in the region can make the contribution in the way they only seem to know how to do, which is making money available. And of course, that will come with strings. We've seen that time and time again, whether we're talking about Lebanon or Jordan or Egypt or other countries. Saudi Arabia tries to basically define foreign policy using checkbook diplomacy. And of course, anything that's done by Saudi Arabia and those other regional Arab nations that are on good terms with them will be looking to exact something in return, no doubt at the expense of Iran. I don't think Palestinians will be up for that. In fact, Palestine is one of the few places where the usual sectarian nonsense doesn't seem to play out anywhere near like it does in other parts of the Islamic world. And at the end of the day, the world's going to have to come to the table. Somebody's going to have to pay for the damage done. Gaza has to be rebuilt. And the siege has to be lifted, and the occupiers have to leave and stay out of Gaza.
An issue that we just spoke about with Mr. Grossman was the fact that will the Israelis uphold this ceasefire agreement? Because we've seen the Israeli regime constantly violating the ceasefire agreement that it reached with Lebanon. So there's a big question mark over whether the Israeli regime will uphold its end of the bargain. Of course, we know a number of ceasefires with the Hamas resistance group in Gaza has been overlooked and has been broken by the Israeli regime. What assurances can there be in this term with regards to the upholding of this ceasefire?
If we have learned any lessons throughout this latest round of the Zionist genocide in Palestine, is that the way there are no insurances in negotiation with Western powers. There are no insurances in basically the so-called international community. All of these basically UN and all of these other organizations. So there are no assurances with this. The main assurance actually is the resistance itself. So the reason the Zionist regime has come forth with the ceasefire deal, the reason an American president has agreed with the ceasefire deal, is not that, you know, they were like, okay, there was enough killing. Okay, I guess 46,000, well over 46,000, because that's just a confirmed death. I mean, there are estimates for well over 100,000, you know, people being murdered, having been murdered, tens of thousands of children. So it's not like the American president was like, okay, I guess that was enough people killed. No, they lost the battle. They realized that this is an existential threat for the Zionist regime, that if they want, they said, they realized that this weapon of genocide, it doesn't work. They cannot basically stand up against the Palestinian resistance, Lebanese resistance, Yemeni resistance, and of course Iran, that has been helping the resistance behind the scenes for decades now. They have realized that this weapon does not work, and so they have put forth a ceasefire deal. This only means, and basically, that they have accepted defeat. And of course, this means that, of course, yes, the Israeli regime, as they have already done, is that following ceasefire, they will kill people. They have killed people, just like they killed Palestinians hours after the ceasefire deal was reached and announced, right? But what happens is that at least they know that every time they hit, they will be hit back. And this is the only thing that will help any aggressor, that will stop any aggressor from committing crimes, is that there is a greater power. And so, I mean, we don't talk about it enough, how much the Yemeni resistance alone, how many billions of dollars the Israeli regime and the Western hegemonic front has suffered as a result of the Yemeni resistance capturing these ships that were facilitating genocide, that they would have to go all the way, completely change the route, and, you know, basically not be able to get a lot of what they actually wanted to give, a lot more of what they wanted to give to the Zionist regime. They realized that how many, I mean, just over $40 billion, and that's just recently, right? I mean, forget about all those billions of dollars that the U.S. had spent, had invested in the Zionist regime over the years at the cost of its taxpayers suffering major losses. Now we see what's happening to Los Angeles. Do they have the funds to basically help their own people? Of course not, you know, or they would not allocate, they wouldn't care to allocate. But whatever it is, the reason we have the ceasefire in place is not because they said this is a ceasefire negotiation. There were many proposals. Now, as you said, I mean, as our guest said, Biden had already proposed, you know, because he foresaw that they could not keep this longer, you know, earlier on. But of course, Netanyahu didn't accept. And the, you know, unless they see that they cannot go forth anymore, they will not stop. But we have to remember, the weapon of the West is not just genocide. The weapon of the West is not just, you know, billions of dollars worth of military and bunker busters and all of that, right? Another weapon of the West is actually negotiations. It has used negotiations to disarm countries and then bomb them, like what they did to Libya. So now, what did Trump say following the ceasefire? Of course, he said, oh, we're happy that, you know, the captives are, you know, the American and Israeli captives are going to come back home. And what we're going to do, they're not going to sit back. What Trump is planning to do, and what the whole Western hegemonic front is planning to do, is to basically continue with a soft war as opposed to the Holocaust that they brought about, that it did not work, that it did, of course, it killed hundreds, I mean, it killed thousands and thousands of people, but it wasn't able, they weren't able to reach their goals. So what they want to expand now is the Abraham Accords, right? So when Trump is talking about this, they want to have, they want to increase their allies. They want to have more and more countries sign peace treaties with the Israeli regime. Now we know, for instance, the Saudi regime was actually going to sign the peace deal before this latest round of genocide in Palestine. And of course, that got delayed because of everything. So if they want to expand the Abraham Accord, what people have to do, people have to be aware, because they have to push those in power. They should not allow this to happen, because of course, basically, this is what the Israeli regime, the American regime, they have only switched their weapons from military weapons to negotiations. But in as far as will they breach the ceasefire deal, of course they will. They already have, and they have always had. They have never remained true to any ceasefire deal, to any deal they have had in their history. However, they know if they hit, they will be hit back by resistance, and they will be hit back hard. It will be a very painful hit, militarily and economically as well.
So we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to Press TV's very own Mariam Alzatir joining us in our studio here in Tehran. And also special thanks to international lawyer Mr. Barry Grossman joining us from Bali, Indonesia. That's it with this segment of our in-depth coverage of the Gaza ceasefire. We're going to go for a short break, but we'll be back on the bottom of the hour with more into this top story of the day. Bye for now.